Take a network break. Just a heads up, you might want to eat around the secret microphones in our virtual donuts. This is our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got stories on Google Cloud, Chrome browser extensions, security bugs, and more. Today's episode is brought to you in part by ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the enterprise cyber analytic company delivering performance and security from the inside out. Visit extrahop.com/packetpushers for an interactive demo to find out more. And you can learn new stuff without getting on a plane. That's because the next Packet Pushers Virtual Design Clinic is Thursday, March 14th. We're going to have technical presentations on IPv6 and the P4 programming language. And we're also going to have Ask Me Anything sessions with expert panelists and a sponsored presentation. Go to packetpushers.net/VDC for details and to register. And don't forget, it's free.
Yeah, it's free. And it's also quite cool. We have sponsored and unsponsored presentations. So it's not like a webinar when someone's trying to shove something down your throat in a really dumb way. These are people like you and I talking and trying to do their best to get some information across to you. And if you've got questions, you don't have to be on the actual thing. If you want to have a question, you can go to packetpushers.net/AMA and ask your question in advance and send it in. And then we'll put it in the list of questions. And if you're lucky, you'll get selected and we'll get a panel of people to argue about the question that you've asked. How cool is that?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So you can even pre-ask your question. So,
start thinking.
Yeah. Think asynchronously. Don't have to do everything in real time. You don't have to be in a classroom. You don't have to go to a conference to get, a conversation going.
That's right. All right, yeah, packetpushers.net/VDC, check it out. All right, let's get to some news. Google has released a beta version of its cloud services platform, or CSP, and like Azure Stack and AWS Outpost, cloud services platform is a hybrid cloud solution that lets you run Google software on-premises or in Google's public cloud.
Yes, it's not enough to have the public cloud in a public space. You've also got to have public cloud in a private space.
I don't know how that works, but yes.
Yes, that's right, and it seems to be all the rage. It's a bit like the latest fashion in clothes. So just because Azure Stack and AWS Outposts. Now, the thing to note here from me is that we discussed this about a year ago after the Google Next conference last year.
That's right. Google teased this at the Google Next conference last year.
That's right. So it's not like this shouldn't be a surprise. We did talk about it. Although unlike the AWS and Azure Stack, it doesn't really have VMs. It's very container-centric, which I think is quite a bit different.
Yeah, it's built on Google Kubernetes Engine and also includes Google Kubernetes Engine on-prem, which sounds like they're saying it's a managed service where Google will manage your Kubernetes environment on your premises.
That's right. So the Google Cloud Platform will manage the Google Cloud Engine that they put on your premises. And that's fine insofar as it goes. So as long as you've got containers and you love containers and you want containers and you have containers and you're going to use containers, you can have any type of container you like, but you can't have VMs. Or databases right. As a service. So there's a few things missing here, which puts them a little bit, I think, behind some of their competitors. So we're seeing things like the other company, like AWS, is saying, right now it's VMs, and we've got some databases or service stuff there, and a bit, and some internet control and that sort of stuff. But Google doesn't seem to have done that. So I think it might be fair to say that they're a little bit behind, but. What Google is doing is they're saying you don't have to have our hardware. So
that's right.
Azure Stack says you can use the hardware from Cisco, HPE, Dell, and Lenovo, but otherwise you don't get a lot of choices. Google's saying you can use any hardware you like. But I do remember last year we were talking about it. There was a partnership announced where Cisco came on stage and were very proud to say their hyperconverged platform would be the blessed hardware solution for this. And then, of course, Nutanix did the same thing. So I'm not 100% sure when they say your hardware, do they actually mean any hardware or do they just mean Cisco and Nutanix, in which case it's not any hardware? So a couple of questions there that I haven't quite got answered in my head.
That's right. Still some questions. They're also trying to distinguish by saying that they've got built-in support for Istio. So if you're using service meshes in your container environments, they're ready and waiting for you. And they're also talking about having identity management built in, for role-based access control, which is, I think, a nice, compelling differentiator.
Well, you're going to need something, because if you're going to run their network inside of your network, you're going to need some sort of an overlay. So I'm guessing that they're using Istio as the overlay or making a big deal about it. But, certainly the service mesh idea is a competitive advantage or a differentiator, at least, against the others, because AWS is still catching up on the service mesh idea, maybe in part because it doesn't need it in the same way that GKE does. But you could. That's a whole argument that probably is better held out on the Data Notch channel, to be fair.
But let them worry about it.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I think the people who know about this, from a networking point of view, if you're going to start putting these other people's edge computing infrastructure inside your data center. It's going to be interesting to understand how that changes your network strategy. Are you going to give them their own switches? Are you going to put them out, you know, just connect them up somewhere? And how do you secure all of that and keep it all sane? I'm not 100% sure that that makes sense at this point.
Yeah, and we should be clear, this is a beta, so presumably they've got a lot more details to straighten out, but we do have links to a story about it from the Register, as well as Google's own documentation, the small amount that's there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it works. I'm just a bit concerned, you know, a bit confused, because usually these software needs to be run on blessed hardware, because apparently there's magic in certain types of hardware. I do know that AWS, for example, has their own custom hardware. There was an article published this week by one of the AWS people about their Nitro chipset. And their Nitro chipset was originally once a hardware accelerator for the network card. So it was actually a 10 gig, 25 gig accelerator. And now it's gone on to be a trusted services module for the entire motherboard.
Yeah, that's James Hamilton wrote that, and it's in our most recent human infrastructure newsletter, but I'll grab that link and throw it in here as well.
Yeah, and they were talking a lot about how, and if that's in their hardware that they're shipping to site, there is a genuine differentiator here, because they can actually certify that the VMs that are booting have come from the AWS store. And I haven't seen that sort of validation coming from Google. Google's a little bit looser around the security requirements. AWS seems to have that, you know, it's got that advantage. It's a few years ahead of most everybody else. So lots of little things like that Google needs to catch up on.
Well, speaking of public cloud and where Google needs to catch up,
do you like that?
Reuters
has like that segue.
That's nice. You teed me up so beautifully. It's like we planned this.
Yeah, we didn't, but
now you just wrecked it too. Yeah. So anyway, Reuters has examined regulatory filings from approximately 5,000 global companies to measure penetration of the big three cloud providers. Of those 5,000 filings, Reuters found 311 companies that reported on their public cloud deployments. And as you might guess, Amazon leads the way. Here's the numbers. 227 companies reported using AWS. Azure was reported by 69 companies, and only 35 named Google.
Yeah, this is pretty much in line with what we've heard. And behind-the-scenes conversations that I've had with senior executives at various of the IT brands would suggest that, to me, that the adoption of public cloud is far higher than most people realize, even infrastructure engineers. Just about all of the big companies have some projects going on in the cloud. And the general intention is to put the vast majority of their IT into public cloud. And these companies can back this up with data. So they actually have these cloud purchasing products that do the analyze of the cloud spend. And that, from that, you can go to Cisco or HPE or Dell and buy a cloud pricing tool that you can put in. But all that data goes back to those companies, and they're using that to predict the growth of the public cloud, right? So it's a sale, you know, even though they're selling it to you as a service, you're also giving away sales intelligence to your suppliers, which is a delightful little exercise. Those trends show that public cloud is certainly going to dominate. It's going to be very structural. So this makes sense. Now, if you follow, there's a website I follow called Platformonomics, and their measurement relates to how much capital these companies are spending. And their point would be is that if you follow the CapEx, you can see that Amazon is pretty much outspending everybody else. And their debate would be is that if you want to know which cloud is the most successful, then follow who's spending the money, because CapEx is a leading indicator of scale and size. The argument sort of passes the sniff test, at least to me.
I mean, in some ways, it's nice that we have these numbers from Reuters. And I should say that just because they only found 311 companies out of 5,000 reporting, that doesn't mean it's only 311 companies using cloud. It's just that companies aren't required to report on their cloud usage in their regulatory filing. So it's just, for whatever reason, these companies decided they were going to make this information public. So, but what we've heard sort of incidentally is that Amazon is far and away out front. We can see every time Amazon holds an event, they've got 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 new services they're releasing. So their acceleration pace is outstanding. And of course, Azure's trucking along right behind, and then Google's playing catch up.
Yeah, I think Google's, and again, Google's not focused on the cloud market like AWS or Azure is. You know, Azure is absolutely the future of Microsoft, and Microsoft Office isn't going to cut it, nor is Microsoft Windows, if you like.
Exactly. Right, so. Yeah, Microsoft was smart enough to realize that its future was in the cloud and went there pretty quickly. At Google, you know, it's still basically an ad revenue company. Google Cloud is sort of a skunkworks project compared to the money they make from their advertising business.
Yeah, and a lot of it is a spin out of what's left over after they've used it internally for ad tech. Like Kubernetes is ultimately like a repackaging of the internal architecture they used that they call Borg, which was the first generation of container architectures. And you just get the sense that Google, if it wants to be a cloud company, it can't just run it as a second or an almost ran. It really needs to start focusing. But it's very hard to imagine that Google would do that while it's got this massive ad business that just spins off wads of cash for almost no effort. So why would you get, you know, why compete with AWS? Just do ads. You
know? Yeah, they want to diversify. I have no idea their logic behind this, but yes, it doesn't seem as critical to their life as it does for Amazon and Azure, which may this is sort of reflected here.
Well, corporate companies have to follow their nature. If you're, you know, if companies are sales companies and all they do is sell something, they're not very good at developing technology. If you're, you know, if your company is a technology company, then you're often not very good at selling something, you know, and, or if you focused on a, if your core is built around one thing and you try and develop a product that's not related to that thing, companies often fail. That's just sort of existing business. That's why you have different companies. You don't have one big company doing everything around the world. Right. You have lots of business units all largely grouped around the same thing because you get benefits from grouping together. And if you try and have a CEO at the top trying to run two different businesses, it usually fails. General Electric collapsed after a while. It was originally intended to be a conglomerate. Even Hyundai and those types of companies in South Korea with the Chaebols, they all fell apart in the end because running all of those businesses is quite difficult. Samsung continues to do it but hasn't exactly been a market winner in every single category that it's in. So, you know, I think the point here is that, yes, Amazon and Azure actually have substantial interest in making this work. How Amazon manages to do AWS and yet continue the Amazon online business is still quite a feat to me and quite something to be impressed by.
That's right. All right, moving on. The security company Duo Security, recently acquired by Cisco, has released a new tool for security teams to track the safety of Chrome browser extensions.
Yeah, this is interesting research. Duo, of course, is mainly an identity management company, particularly focused around perimeterless networking. So it's very focused on the endpoint. And somebody has a research project inside the organization, as far as I can tell, got concerned about the nature of Chrome plugins. And really, when you think about it, a Chrome plugin, when you add it to Chrome, and it's very easy to add one to Chrome, and they quite often say, we want to access all the data. We want to read it, write it, keep it, store it, steal it, whatever. So what they did was built this tool called CRXcavator, which is kind of digging into the Chrome. It's a bit of as a metaphor or a name.
It's a little pun, yes.
Stretching the...
Well, they're having some fun.
They're having some fun. Like, security people need to stop having fun and try and take themselves seriously and act like grown-ups, I think. But, you know, having a fancy name for your product is all well and good, but don't try and stretch it too far where it becomes like, no, not so much. Anyway, they discovered that something like of the 95,000 extensions in the web store that have a content security policy, so they literally searched through all, you know, 300,000 of them, they found that 75,000 of them have no content security policy defined, even though they claim they have, and 94,000 extensions do not have details about the content source policy defined. So, and more than a third of all Chrome extensions ask users for permissions to access and read all their data on any website. So if you have a Chrome plugin and then you're using it on an internal enterprise application, all of that data could be being sent outside of your organization unless you've got egress filtering of some sort, and you would be screwed. All of your fancy security policy would all be done if you're actually using Chrome and letting people install these plugins. So I, you know, I've always knew that was possible. I just hadn't quite twigged to the fact of just how much of a security breach it was in terms of enterprise technology.
Yeah, so what this tool is doing, the CRXcavator, is looking at those Chrome extensions from a variety of perspectives, including whether the extension accesses outdated software libraries. Again, you talked about the permissions, what it's actually going to do, and also the sites the extension's calling back to. And they built this project because, as you noted, there are hundreds of thousands of these extensions available. And so, you know, an individual security team just wouldn't be able to get their arms around what's going on with browser extensions in their own organization. So,
yes, and
yeah,
a lot
it's
of
a pretty
people,
cool project.
And, you know, 60% of browsers in the world are Chrome. So in theory, a lot of enterprises must be using this. And there's high risk of theft of, you know, proprietary internal data going on here if you're doing it. So something to think about. And this is where Firefox really is much better than Chrome. I actually wouldn't use Chrome because of this exact purpose, because I think while Google takes the security of the browser seriously, it completely falls down on things like plugins and ad blocking.
Extensions,
yeah. And extensions. It just says, like, yeah, whatever. It's a wild frontier. Knock yourself out. If you want to be stupid, that's not our problem. It's not us. Whereas, you know, the obverse of this, of course, is what Apple's done, which is it made it very difficult to put extensions into Safari to the point where it's very difficult to get one that actually goes in because they have to be signed and so they can be revoked. And so
right.
I think Chrome, the browser might be secure, but I think the ecosystem as a whole, anything to do with Google has to be assumed to be unsafe because Cisco forgets to do security holistically. They do it in part only.
That's right, and I think that was part of the driving force behind this project in that folks think Chrome, that's a good secure browser, but extensions you may be adding on could have significant problems with no way for you to really know. So that's the point. And this is typically Google's operating model. Yeah. We see it with Android where they built this operating system and then, you know, whatever you want to add onto it, fine. And you compare that to how Apple does it with its walled garden. You know, there are benefits and drawbacks to each, but
yeah,
in some cases, I'd rather be in the walled garden.
Yeah, sometimes Google's like school kids. It's like, yeah, no, we're finished playing that game, so we'll just throw that product away. Or, yeah, we did that, but we didn't really want to finish it off, so, you know, whatever. You do really get the sense that it's like, you know, school kids playing at being adults sort of thing. And this is another sort of evidence of that to me.
All right, moving on. Palo Alto Networks is going to spend $500 million to acquire Demisto, which is a security orchestration and automation company.
Really sounds like an auto accessory, doesn't it?
Demisto? How to clear your windshield on
that's right.
Snowy days.
Spray this on your inside of your screen. Demisto. You won't get misted up on the inside. You know, something. I don't just. Anyway, sorry. So $500 million for Demisto. This is very much in the SDN software-defined type space. Demisto pitches itself as a security orchestration, not just an automation tool, my friend, an orchestration tool. Not only does it wipes twice, apparently. Not only does it orchestrate Palo Alto firewalls, it orchestrates a number of third-party security tools to bring them together. So their website sort of explains it, and what they're trying to say is that this automation tool will start replacing task-oriented human work. So that is the idea of configuring firewalls and so forth that will do it. And if you look up on the website, it has picture drag-and-drop workflow tools, so you don't actually have to do a programming language. You can actually get in there, and there's a lot of automation. If you want to just create a rule, you don't have to actually create arcane Ansible scripts. You just go in there and do it all for you. So makes sense. I think this is yet another example of a security product becoming a feature. So I claim that my prediction continues to hold true.
Yeah, my take is that Demisto is very much focused on incident response, on being able to correlate and analyze the thousands or millions of alerts that are coming in so that you can actually find out what the heck is really going on, and then doing that security orchestration to stitch together some kind of automated response. So, you know, make sure there are humans in the loop, but automate as much as you can. Of course, they sprinkle in machine learning in their marketing here and there, as you would expect. Mm. But clearly, you know, response is the current hotness in the security industry. We've cottoned on to the fact that we can't actually stop breaches. So the goal now is to identify and remediate as quickly as possible. And to do that, you do need some kind of visibility and automation tool.
Yeah. So, but as long as you're a Palo Alto customer, in theory, you could put this over the top and you'll get some benefits. And I think this is also a reaction to the number of firewalls or the number of security tools that are going to company. Remember, I've been flagging over the last year that companies just have too many security tools, too much stuff going on,
right,
and too many brands, too many vendors. And the obvious way to solve this is to put a layer over the top. So this probably means the end of Palo Alto as a firewall company. And in the same way that Cisco ACI stop people thinking about switches, the Nexus 9000 switches become less relevant or less important, and you spend far more time talking about ACI or, you know, NSX is the same thing, any SDN platform. I think you'll start to see Palo Alto start emphasizing its orchestration as a way to lock customers in. The money might come from selling the switches and the firewalls, but it shifts the emphasis up into workflows and value adding and changes the nature of the sales engagement. So you're going to need to be smart about buying and realize what they're doing when they're pitching you stuff and make sure you understand the ROI calculations.
Yeah, security companies that want to be around for the long haul, I think, see that they can't just sell point solutions anymore. They need to sell you a sort of all-encompassing suite. Mm. And hopefully you will buy all the components of their suite, but they'll also presumably make some sort of effort to integrate with third parties. But you can't, I think, in the long term, get away with just selling one product anymore.
No, but this is true of anybody in the public cloud is taking away a lot of the functionalities that happened in firewalls. And NSX, for example, is putting firewalls into the virtual switch. Where does that leave a firewall company? Where you stop being a firewall business, you have to become a security business. Well, what do you do? You know.
Yeah. Well, but frankly, I also think analytics, visibility, being able to aggregate and correlate all of the security data that's coming in, that's a real problem. Whether or not these folks have actually solved it, I don't know, but it is an actual significant issue that needs some work. So sure, yeah, it seems like a legitimate space to get into. Whether or not it works, we have to see, but yes, there's a problem.
This is the natural progression. But at the same time, if I'm a software-defined networking company, I can be doing the security as part of the network.
That's true, yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. So you're right. Yes, so security.
You can have a security controller over there and have your network controller over here. You know, your NSX is here, but over there is your, you know, PAN Demisto. You can't have two over time. They have to converge. So the question's going to be, who's going to win?
Yep.
Interesting to
see.
Who's
going to own all that delicious security data?
Because welding them all together is a significant challenge for us, but that's what we're here for, is to help work that out, I guess. We'll be spectating from the sidelines.
All right, a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, ExtraHop. You're responsible for managing the applications and infrastructure that modern enterprises depend on, but legacy monitoring tools can leave you scrambling because of limited instrumentation and slow manual workflows. ExtraHop helps IT and network teams rise above the noise of alerts, silos, and tool sprawl so that you can act with confidence. ExtraHop gives you complete visibility across the hybrid enterprise. It uses machine learning trained on 4,600 metrics to provide real-time anomaly detection and guided investigations that take you from issue to packet in a matter of clicks. And don't just take our word for it, ExtraHop has created an interactive demo at extrahop.com/packetpushers so you can go see it for yourself. Once again, that's extrahop.com/packetpushers, and we thank ExtraHop for being a sponsor.
Visibility is key. You can have all the SDN tools in the world, but day two is far more important than day zero and day one. That's the trick here.
That's right. All right, speaking of security, millions of websites may be vulnerable to a remote code execution vulnerability in the Drupal content management system. Drupal is one of the most widely deployed CMSs. They power the content backends of websites, and the vulnerability is rated as highly critical. It could allow attackers to execute arbitrary PHP code.
Yeah, Drupal has had a long history of vulnerabilities. I think the best recommendation I could give you is don't use Drupal. Now, WordPress is not exactly the most secure or wondrous content management system or others, but Drupal's had a fairly torrid time over the last 3 or 4 years. At this point, I would just say that the whole product's fundamentally flawed and you shouldn't be there. Because year in, year out, we see highly critical vulnerabilities like this going on and on and on.
Yeah, it's tough, though, once you've locked into years and years of a CMS to get out of it. It's very hard work, so.
I agree. I'm not gonna argue. But.
In any case, but. So, well, whatever. Regardless, whether or not you regret your Drupal adoption, that there's a vulnerability, so get to patching.
Yeah, if you've already got it, get to patching. But if you haven't got it, don't get it, is my considered advice.
There you go. All right, we've been covering the ongoing dispute between the United States and China over Huawei, and there's a new advancement. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has warned that it will no longer share intelligence with U.S. allies that use Huawei gear in their critical infrastructure. Pompeo, who made these comments in an interview with the Fox Business program, went on to say the presence of Huawei equipment might even influence whether the U.S. will put military bases or embassies in countries using Huawei gear.
Now, that's fairly aggressive posturing.
That's straight up aggressive. Yeah,
for politicians. But it has to be said that the current U.S. government does like to make fairly strong-worded statements and then fail to sort of follow through. So yes, it would be reasonable to assume that this is more posturing than otherwise. We'd have to wait and see what the evidence is. You know, it's the old story is you can say whatever you like, but really we need to be seeing the reality of what you're trying to say or whether it's worthwhile. Now, the flip side of this is we saw this week that the UK has turned around and said, we think we can control the risks around the Huawei, so we're not going to plan on throwing it out. So
that's that.
And then also Germany piped up and said, we're still deciding, but we may not block Huawei from its 5G plans in the German countries. Now, that is flying in the face of what the US Secretary of State has said. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and just to clarify on the British aspect, the head of Britain's National Cybersecurity Center says that Britain has the capability to contain any threats that Huawei might pose. It hasn't actually given a ruling on whether they'll allow Huawei equipment going forward, but they seem confident that they can contain any potential risk, and they say that they also haven't as yet detected any malicious activity from Huawei. Mm. And again, you noted Germany saying, you know, we're still on the fence about it. Having the U.S. just sort of flat out threatened on intelligence sharing and military bases and embassies is such a boneheaded, dumb, bullying move. It makes no sense.
I mean, there's a certain sort of a sense to it if you take a certain point of view. But I think it really is time for the – if the US government wants to make its case, it needs to get its spy agencies to publish hard proof that this is an issue. So put it out in public. If you believe that Huawei's got some – if you've got some dirt on Huawei, now is the time to put it out there and follow up and say – because – if the British and the German governments are making statements that they're not going to exclude Huawei, they must not be getting backroom information from the US spy agencies to show hard proof. Because if they thought there was a systemic risk, their spy agencies would saying to the leaderships of those companies, this is, in theory at least, don't do this, right? Now, keep in mind here that you could read this reaction as an attempt to bolster the US technology company. So if I'm somebody who makes 5G equipment, if I'm Qualcomm or Cisco or HPE, right, those sorts of companies who make 5G assets, they would be loving this because they know that that the US government is basically saying buy US. And in the case of Europe, there's also Nokia and Ericsson, which are much better positioned to use 5G by comparison. But and the flip side of this is that following the US direction of saying don't buy Huawei will cost a lot of money. The Huawei gear is substantially cheaper than the competitors. And so as a nation, you're talking billions of dollars of potential savings. Very difficult to just say, yeah, he said it's not safe, so we're not going to, you know, the US government says it's not safe. Where's the proof? So I think the onus is now on the US government to show us where the real risk is, like to prove what the claims that they're making and make it worthwhile.
That's right.
And keep in mind, too, here that also in Germany in particular, the US NSA, National Spying Agency, was actually caught spying on the German Prime Minister, Angela Merkel, on her phone during financial negotiations, right, during trade negotiations. So not a lot of love lost between the German Secret Service and the US Secret Service when, you know, even though you're an ally, you're spying each other. That wasn't a good look. And also, the Snowden documents talked a lot about long-term economic espionage in France. So again, using their secret services to get a trade advantage against France. So, and then just to make things worse, we saw the Huawei CEO deliver some trash talk this week. Did you see that article? It was a clacker.
It was essentially saying the US won't be able to put us out of business.
Yeah, that's right. Because they've got very strong contacts into Asia. So obviously China, but also the whole Asian region is very price sensitive, and particularly Africa, where they have substantial penetration into the African market. Now, you may say that Africa's not really a market. No, it's not actually high value, but it's enough. Keep in mind that Huawei is already twice as big as Cisco, actually quite a bit bigger than about 2.5 times the size of Cisco. So it's pretty large, and it does have very substantial innovation engine developing technologies. Just this week, they've released a bunch of ARM-related servers that are compliant with SUSE, so they're Taishan servers, now SUSE certified, which is a European distro that's quite widely used by telcos under the hood. You might not know that, but that's what is done. And they do have released various 5G. They have quite a wide portfolio of 5G technology, perhaps at least as complete as Nokia and Ericsson. So very complicated issue, very complicated issue. I think the US needs to prove itself and say, this is the evidence we've got, here it is.
Right, they should make a case instead of just trying to strong-arm people.
Yes, or, you know, but if you don't want to release that because you're having a trade dispute with China, well, then you're going to have to find another way to get the facts out there. So complicated issue, complicated issue.
All right, let's step away from politics to talk about some financial news. HPE released its first quarter financial results. The company posted revenues of $7.6 billion, which is down 1.6% year over year. They had profits of $456 million, up 100% year over year. Although some other numbers don't look so good, net earnings were down 88% year over year, but the company says that is a one-time blip due to U.S. tax reform.
Yeah, so the numbers are all over the place. The share price actually shot up substantially because it's better than expected. Yes, they're talking about shrinking revenues, but a lot of that's to do with the divestiture from HPE to Micro Focus and the ownership of that. So a lot of them, you know, something like half the value of the company. Keep in mind that HPE now is booking revenues of $7.6 billion. Cisco's doing just over $12.5 billion a quarter. So the new HPE is a very different animal. The one thing that I drew out of the numbers, which I think might be relevant to a network break audience, is that HPE said that they're pulling out of professional services in a fairly substantial number of companies. They're saying that the drag on the numbers is actually due to the APS, which is the Advanced and Professional Services teams. And so, and I'll quote here from Antonio Neri, who's the CEO of HPE. Most importantly, we grew significantly in high margin value categories like high performance compute, hyper-converged and composable infrastructure. Our continued mix shift, as well as ongoing cost management and supply chain simplification, improved our operating leverage. So we improved our gross margins by 280 basis points. So in other words, they're getting better at their supply chain. They're getting more margin on servers and hyper-converged platforms, storage arrays and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But the next piece that he said, somebody asked him about why APS wasn't working. He said, well, and I quote, I said earlier in my HP Next commentary is the fact that we are really refocusing advisory and professional services in fewer countries so we can make big investments where we can drive the pull through above our software-defined infrastructure, our intelligent edge, and the attach that goes with it. So instead of being in 170 countries, we are going to be in fewer countries, and that work is well underway, and that's declining revenue we saw in Q1. So there was a whole business unit inside of HPE which was doing professional services, often taking entire outsourcing contracts. They divested most of that into DXC when HPE broke up into pieces. But what you're seeing now is that what's left of that business unit, they're actually walking away from that global footprint. I think that's significant. HPE is not going to be an IBM. You know, that IBM says, we've got an office in every country. We've right. got arms and legs. They're all quality. They're all whatever. And what HPE is saying here is, we're not going to be in every country in the world. We're just going to be in the ones which are profitable. And that's a real change, I think. That's a sea change that I don't think people have picked up on.
I think it's a smart focus, though, for HPE, because that's sort of also kind of what got IBM in trouble, this wanting to be this global advisory services company. That's a lot of manpower or person power to maintain. And HPE's got to focus.
You could point the finger at the cloud here, too, but I think customers don't need professional services so much. If you're buying hyperconverged, you don't need a team of storage and...
Presumably you shouldn't.
Yeah, right. And if you're going to the public cloud, a lot of the professional services that would come is going away. And remember, they got rid of a lot of their apps. So they went to Micro Focus. They have their own professional right. services function. So I think the market's changing. The need for vendor-supplied professional services is going away as the products simplify to some extent. So the idea of, you know, hand-cranking your storage array and artisanally crafting your network and then, you know, manually defining all of your servers and every VM's, you know, manually created and managed, those days are passing us by as the hyper-converged and composable infrastructure replaces that effort. So, yeah, I think this is a major trend, you know, shifting to channel, that is relying on resellers to do work locally, is probably where they're going to do. So,
yeah, well, we'll see what the next quarter brings for HPE. All right, our last story for the day. Google apologized for not informing customers that its Nest Secure home security device included a built-in microphone. Surprise!
I'm in two sides about this, Drew. One part of me wants to say this is not a good thing to sell a product with a microphone in it and then not say in the spec sheet there's a microphone and it not be enabled. On the other hand, this is a Nest Guard. So this isn't a Nest thermostat or a Nest smoke extinguisher, you know, the smoke detector. This is the security feature, the security. So when you walk through the door, you type in a PIN pad code. And if you don't, then it knows that somebody's just broken into your house, right? And that's the purpose of it. I would sort of expect that to have a microphone in this era. That's not a product that was built 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So like part of me wants to say is, you know, Google is a Silicon Valley company and they want to move fast and break things and that just means low morals and bad behavior is normal practice, right? So, and I could imagine Nest would just put a microphone in there expecting to be voice activated at some point, but going, we won't tell anybody because like they don't need to know and they might not buy it if they knew. We'll worry about that tomorrow. Forget it, you know. And
I think that's how Google got caught out because they're now essentially integrating it with their Google Voice assistant so that you could presumably, you know, read out your PIN instead of having to type it in or whatever. I think there's also supposed to be a feature where it will heal something like a breaking glass and then alert you to say, hey, did a window just break? But that came out and they were like, yeah, that has these cool features. And people were like, wait, how does it do it without a microphone? And they were like, oh, yeah, we shipped it with a microphone. We just neglected to mention that.
It's pretty easy to imagine, you know, evil PR people sitting there around a table with glasses of alcohol going, ah, we've been caught out now. How can we spin this so it doesn't look like it's our fault? You know, it's like, oh, we've forgot to tell you there was a microphone in there. Oh, bad.
You said earlier you sometimes feel like Google acts like a bunch of fourth graders with their homework. That's exactly the fourth grader response. Yeah, I forgot.
It is a really bad response to just say, I forgot. And, you know,
it's terrible.
The flip side of it is, what can you say? Right? Yeah, we knew. You caught us. Whatever.
I'd find it refreshing if they're like, yep, we're busted.
We're busted. Suck it up because you still love us.
You're buying it anyway, dumbs.
Yeah, you dumb schmucks. You bought the product name. I guess the flip side of this is that Google and the Google Voice Assistant versus Alexa versus Siri, that's a real war zone in terms of business. I don't like war metaphors because I think it really cheapens things. So I shouldn't say that, but it is really an area where all the companies, and one of the ways that they can convince customers to start using these products is to put them everywhere. That's why they're producing these really cheap pucks and making it possible for people to buy them and play with them and then put them straight in the bin about a day later when they realize how pointless they are. And part of me wants to say they're just being scummy because they just want to shove the Google Voice Assistant down people's throats. But another part of me says, a security device with audio functions is a possibility, is actually kind of useful. So I can see both sides, but they definitely got caught with their pants down. Liar, liar, pants on fire type thing.
Well, that wraps up this episode. Where can folks get more from you, Greg?
I'll be doing more childish stuff on my personal blog at etherealmind.com, where I've been publishing. Not so much this week. I wasn't able to get any writing out. I did a really interesting podcast on Quos this week, which will come out, and that took an awful lot of research to be able to come up to speed and talk to Kristen Hewitt-Thiemer. But check out etherealmind.com and also check out our YouTube channel, which we've published some videos lately. If you haven't, you might be interested in seeing those.
That's right. Ethan's starting to catch up on video production on you, Greg.
Yeah, I'll have to get my camera out and start again. Is it time to go to the pub and drink beers?
I think it is. I think that's what I'm saying. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsor, ExtraHop. And of course, thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell your friends, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. You can also check out our membership program. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got free and paid membership options. When you sign up, you get the Human Infrastructure Magazine. We've got a whole bunch of content, and we're building out the content library, so go check it out. And as always, thanks for listening.